Chico. Follow Om Foods on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Om Foods thanks you for keeping the community safe. You want to stay tuned momentarily for Peace and Social Justice. Jesse is here to host. And I'll leave you with just a little bit of this. Third Friday of the month at Peace and Social Justice here on listener-supported community radio, KZFR. We have got an interesting show. I tell you what, you know, COVID world is starting to take its toll on me. I know it's taken toll on people for a lot of different reasons, but I miss having live guests in the studio. I miss so many things, but one of the things that I miss most is the live guests that we're able to have here in the studio. As much fun as it is to pre-record things and all of that, I am looking forward to the day that we can get on that bandwagon again and get out there and get some live guests into the studio. A show that I've got lined up for you today kind of deals with the question of what happens when we get back to normal. And so that's a question on a lot of folks' minds right now. I am going to, I brought a lot of raw footage audio sound into the studio today because I just got done with one of these interviews. So what I'm going to do is we're going to take a little moment here to see if, there we go, our first interview with Deanna Schwab and Gail Hill. Is not going to happen. So what we're going to do is we're going to go on over to an interview.
Action in Moral Organizing by the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber. I don't know whether you've heard of him, but he is...
Indeed, yeah.
Because I'm... Let's get started.
This is my interview with Ben Colahan, who is the minister at Faith Lutheran Church.
My next guest is Reverend Ben Colahan, who is the pastor. Is pastor your correct term there?
Well, that is indeed, yep.
All right. He is the pastor of Faith Lutheran Church here in Chico, California. And he's been here for how many years now, Ben?
Coming on 5 years.
Really? My gosh, it doesn't seem like it was that terribly long ago when he came to town. So, well, Ben is a person who is quite active in peace and justice issues here in town, and I wanted to have a conversation with him today because I'm struggling. So, Ben, this might be an online confession or an on-air confession that I'm having here today. I don't know. But
we offer absolution of sin in the name of Christ.
Well, that's good. I'm very happy to hear that. Well, last week I finished the book Action in Moral Organizing by the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber. I don't know whether you've heard of him, but he is...
Indeed, yeah.
He is one of ours. He is... a disciple of Christ, pastor in South Carolina. He is best known as the co-chair for the Poor People's Campaign and the founder of Moral Mondays, which is a movement to restore morality in public affairs and in our legislative process. So, Dr. Barber is appealing to his readers, and he wants to appeal to people's sense of morality when it comes to how we treat our fellow human beings, especially those who are socially disenfranchised. So as a pastor, I'm all on board with this. You know, why not appeal to folks' morality when you want to stop discriminating against people based on their income level or their sexual orientation or their social status? So I've been following the activities of a group here in town who are encouraging our city council members to come up with a plan for sheltering our homeless population instead of just moving people out of the encampments without a plan for where they can go. So I'm there in a meeting advocating for making a moral appeal to the council because I've been reading Dr. Barber's books, right? But the consensus of the group seems to be, don't try to appeal to people's morality because it just doesn't work. The only way to get anything done is to show the city leaders how much money they can save by sheltering people. And as much as that bothered me at some level, on another level, I had to confess, you know, they're probably right. Moral appeals seem to fall on deaf ears these days. So Ben, Pastor Ben, colleague Ben, as a fellow minister and as a fellow advocate for motivating people to act morally, Are we just banging our heads up against a wall using moral appeals to deal with our housing crisis?
I don't think we're banging our heads against a wall using moral appeals on any issue.
Okay.
But I do think it's important to understand how and when moral appeals work. Because, you know, the honest truth is they're not always going to convince folks.
Sure.
And, you know, if you make an appeal to morality, in my mind, you're doing one of two things. One, you're trying to scare people, right, to say, you got to do it God's way or you're going to burn in the fires of hell. And so best get right with the Lord. You can try that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the second way you can do it is to appeal to people's sense of compassion and empathy. You know, and I just want to say the honest truth is with the first way, I think there may have been points in history in which that was quite effective. I think our society is at the point where it's not terribly effective anymore.
Right.
Partly because we've become a very secular society.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also partly because the strand of theology that, if I'm honest, has its roots in my Lutheran tradition,
mm-hmm.
Which says we are saved not by our works, but by grace through faith. And so I think there's a fair number of Christians out there who say, I believe that Jesus is my personal Lord and Savior, so I am, you know, I'm now a good person.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to do. I'm not worried about going to hell, and I don't have to care about taking care of people.
Okay.
Now, right, as a pastor, that breaks my heart because that's not what faith is.
Right.
And I think to understand what faith is goes to the empathy and compassion side.
Yeah. Can I back up on that a little bit with the empathy
Sure.
and compassion? You know, when we talk about appealing to people's empathy and compassion, I think that might be what Reverend Dr. Barber is talking about when he's talking about appealing to people's morals. So where do we make that distinction between what is moral, what is morality? And, you know, I think that might be one of the questions that I'm curious about as well.
Right, there are culture wars for a reason.
Yeah.
Which is to say, what is morality is a matter of debate.
Sure.
And, right, you and I come from the Christian tradition, but we come from different strands of the Christian tradition, right? Right now, our traditions play well, but there have been times in centuries past when they would have butted heads, sometimes violently.
Yeah.
And to say, yeah, right, one of the great challenges of society is finding a common morality and trying to get people to live by it together.
Yes.
I think we should come back to that question.
Sure.
Because, right, at the end of the day, you and I as pastors, our job is to try to convince people that Jesus's morality is the yeah. one that they should pay attention to. Because there are other moralities out there.
Sure, yeah.
And people say, well, you know, I'm moral. I believe in social Darwinianism, and if you let the weak survive, then our society is going to get weaker as a whole. And so, I'm doing my part to make us better by not helping other folks. Right? I would disagree with that morality, but that is a morality.
Yeah. There's another book that I'm reading. I don't know whether you've run across it, but it's Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind.
I'm not familiar with that
yeah,
one now.
His premise is that at a very deep instinctive level, all people want to be moral at some level. All yes. people want to do good works. They want to act morally.
I completely agree. And I think, right, that's my point about there are different types of morality, because everyone wants to think, I'm a good person, I'm doing the right thing.
Right.
But the truth is, there are different ways to think of yourself. There are different ways to think of yourself as being a good person, and different ethical systems for what you do to be a good person.
Right.
What, as a pastor, what is, to me, if not completely unique about Jesus, but distinguishing about Jesus's morality, is he says to give up personal privilege to love and serve others. Mm-hmm. Right? To me, that's a core part of Jesus's morality, this idea of take up your cross and follow me. Those who want to save their life must lose it. Jesus has this radical notion that if you want to live the best possible life, mm-hmm. you don't live it for yourself, you live it for other people.
Okay.
And I will tell you, that is not a popular... that's not a popular morality.
No, because it's not easy at all.
It's not easy at all.
Yeah.
I think... those of us who read the Bible frequently and take it seriously are struck by how many things Jesus calls us to do that personally I don't want to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? He's got things in there. Luke 14, right? Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sister, yes, even life itself cannot be my disciple, right? Jesus says, you have to hate your family and even your life to be my disciple.
Yeah.
I got a great wife. I got great family. I love them. I love my life. I don't want to hate that.
Right.
Jesus will tell the rich young man, who wants to be perfect and... who wants to inherit eternal life. He says, that guy, look, you follow all the commandments, but you still lack one thing. Sell all that you own and distribute the money to the poor.
Yeah.
And you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. Right. I don't want to do that. I have a very nice house.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a comfy bed, clothes, a car. I don't want to sell all those things and give the money to the poor. So Jesus has a profound and radical morality that is at odds with the American dream of I'm going to work hard,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to make money, and I'm going to live a comfortable life.
Yeah.
That's not what he calls us to do.
Right. Yeah.
You know, a lot of my preaching is just being honest. I think, like you're trying to do with this episode of talking to my community, my congregation, and saying, okay, this is what Jesus calls us to. Like, where do we find the faith
right.
to actually say, my life will be good, not based on what's in my bank account,
mm-hmm.
But based on what's in my heart?
For sure. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR, and it is time to give some love to our underwriters.
And Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico, and by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and Saturday markets. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. And now back to our interview.
And if you're just tuning in, this is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR. This is your third Friday host of Peace and Social Justice, Pastor Jesse Kearns, talking to Pastor Ben Colahan of Faith Lutheran Church. And we're trying to figure some stuff out. We're trying to figure out how we appeal to people's morality. And we've already been talking about how tough it is to live up to our call to follow Jesus, because Jesus doesn't give us easy things to do. In fact, here's something I was thinking about, Ben. I notice, and I may be wrong, but I notice seems to be that an increasing number of Christian faith communities who, to me, don't seem to say much about Jesus' teachings about caring for the poor. You know, you were talking about sell all your possessions and give to the poor. You know, that's hard for us to do. But, you know, just some basic things, you know. And I've always been taught that when Jesus returned to his hometown synagogue, you know, he'd been out preparing for this public ministry that he was about to go in. And before he started this ministry, he goes out to his hometown synagogue and lays out his vision and mission. And he stood up in the synagogue and he read from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah and said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor." And then after he read the scroll, he said, "Well, that's what I've been sent here to do." And I always assume that faith communities who hang their hat on the Jesus hat rack are familiar with Jesus's teaching. So why do you suppose some faith communities choose not to advocate for the poor, or even some of these simple things? You know, to heck with sell all your possessions and give to the poor. Just bring good news to the poor.
You know, I think this is part of what I talked about earlier, about how American Christianity has taken the good news that our salvation, the fact that we are loved by God and have a promise of eternal life in God's love, the good news is that that is not dependent on what we can achieve in this life.
Okay.
It's not dependent on us being perfect, because none of us are. It's dependent only upon God's love, which in Jesus reveals that God is willing to die that we might have eternal life.
Okay.
And to trust, like when we trust in that, that transforms our existence and sets us free. So that's the good news about Jesus. It's, I think for a lot of Christians, become this idea of, all right, I checked off the box. I believe in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now I don't have to do anything else.
Yeah.
And I think the truth about what faith is, and we as Lutherans talk about a dialectic, a back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Between what we call the law and the gospel. And we define that as, you know, the law is all the parts in the Bible, Old Testament and New, in which God says, here's all the things you need to be doing. And as Lutherans, we say, wow, we don't do those very well. Mm-hmm. In fact, no one does. And if we're perfectly honest, since one of the basic laws is to love others as we love ourselves, and heck, we don't do a very good job of loving ourselves, how much less do it loving others. We say, wow, you know, if we were to be judged based on what we've accomplished, based on what we're worth, all of us would fall short.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is a recognition that we have received so much goodness in our life, so many opportunities, not because of how amazing we are, but because God and the God's Spirit working through people have been generous and compassionate and gracious to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, faith is saying, I have received so much that I don't actually deserve, but I am so grateful for it. But as I look at all these things that I've been given, what do I want to do with them? And first and foremost is our life. What do we want to do with this life that we've been given? And for us to be a person of faith is to say, what I want to do with everything I've been given is to share it with others that they might have it also. Because when we share God's love, that's what eternal life looks like. Eternal life that begins now before we die.
Sure.
And so, right, that's, to me, that's what faith is. It is trusting that God gives us love and life without us having to earn it, so that we can live our life not worried about earning our love, but instead sharing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't speak for what's happening in other congregations.
Oh, yeah.
But it's easy to want to believe that the stuff we have in this life, the goodness we have in this life, that we earned and we deserve.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think to yourself, well, you know, no one gave me a handout. I had to work for everything I have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you don't owe anyone anything. And if you can do it, so can other people. So they should just work hard like you did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a popular message, because it's also a fairly empowering message to say, look, I worked hard, you can work hard.
Mm-hmm.
I got rich, you can get rich.
Yeah.
And that's a very hopeful thing, where honestly the gospel message is to say the whole thing is a scam.
Yeah.
Right? If someone is telling you, well, the reason you're down in the dirt is because you just didn't try hard enough, you start to have to ask yourself, well, okay, like, yes, I have a fault to play in this, but if everyone is down in the dirt, maybe the system isn't working, and maybe we need a new system. And Jesus gave the universe a new system, one that wasn't, all right, like, here's all the rules, you best follow them, otherwise you're going to hell. It was a system that was based on, actually, God loves you because God made you. You're a beloved child of God. God wants you to have life because God rejoices in you.
Right.
And to say, if we could take that message and apply it to everyone, to say, okay, yes, here's someone living on the street. They may have made some terrible choices in life.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been born into a life in which they only had terrible choices as options given to them.
Right.
They made one mistake and then they had no more good choices. To say, look, I have made many mistakes in my life. I have had the privilege of being able to make those mistakes and then have the opportunity to turn my life around.
Right.
Some people don't get that choice. And so part of our call as faith leaders is to remind people of their sin and to say, hey, look, these are all the ways you screwed up. And, you know, I do it not by wagging my finger. I do it by saying, hey, look, here's all the ways I screwed up.
Yeah.
have you done any of those? Let's be honest. And then to say, okay, if I got a second chance, mm-hmm. maybe to someone else who maybe made some poor life choices also deserve a second chance.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by, I think the way to make morality matter to people is through compassion and empathy.
There it is.
Because we have to be able to imagine that we too could be someone in need of help.
Yep.
Before we're willing to help someone. I mean, I wish it weren't that way. But unfortunately, it often is. And that's what I call human sin.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to confess that one of the motivators for me to help people who are on the margins, help people who are without shelter, is that I have a huge fear of being in that position myself. So am I acting justly? Am I acting truly altruistically? If that is what my motivation is, rather than because Jesus tells me to, you know.
Well, here's the thing. Part of one of those radical parts of the Christian faith is this idea that we are connected with everyone else. That those of us who believe in Jesus, we are parts of one body.
Right.
And if the hand is hurting, you better believe the foot is not going to be having a great day.
Right.
And so if you're one part of the body and you see another part of the body hurting, then yes, right, it is, of course, entirely in your self-interest to help that part of the body. If I've got a bloody nose, I'm not like, ha, good thing I'm not my nose.
Mm-hmm.
I go, oh, no, I've got to take care of my nose. So to say, yeah. I don't think we should shy away from the fact that it is in our self-interest to help people, right? It's in our most people recognize it's in their self-interest to help their family members.
Yeah.
And Jesus says in him, we are one family. Yeah. We are all siblings in Christ. So yes, we need to help our family members, and if it means, great, the person who was now sleeping on my porch each night, despite me not wanting them to, now has their own house in which to live.
Mm.
That's a good thing for them, and it's a good thing for me. And now, instead of seeing that person as, oh no, this is a person I'm trying to avoid or I feel uncomfortable around, suddenly helping someone get on their feet, when I see that person, now it's a person I'm excited to see and rejoicing to see. And so it can help us open our hearts when we understand that that each and every person is a family member. And, you know, as we all have families, sometimes our relationships with family members are better than others.
Complicated, yes.
Yeah, right. And it takes work to get those relationships all happy and healthy. And that's true with our siblings who are sleeping on the street.
Right. Now, see, there's an appeal that I think can, you know, like I say, you and I can appeal to people who share our faith, who are seeking our faith. And this is where I think we agree on the morality isn't necessarily pushing a particular faith tradition or a particular value system that involves a relationship with God. You know, we want to live that. Of course, we want to demonstrate that in our lives. But, you know, what do you say to a group of people who are in power who may not share those values to appeal to them to say, here is our brothers and sisters on the street who do not have shelter, who are in places of vulnerability, who are in need, very much in need. And I think that Yeah, okay, we can appeal to people's pocketbooks. Fine.
Sure.
But I still think that there is room for us to appeal to people's ethical do-gooder side, I guess. You know,
yeah.
like you say earlier, we all, and I agree with Haidt, Jonathan Haidt in The Righteous Mind. I believe that we all want to do good. Are we selfish? Heck yeah. We are innately selfish as well, but we also want to be the good guy, and we want to do good. And I still think that there's some room for us to be able to appeal to people's morality and ethics in order to bring about change.
I agree. And, you know, there's a lot of different opinions on how to address the situation we have here in Chico, where there's a housing shortage, where there are a lot of people sleeping in public places.
Yeah.
And almost no one is enthused about that, no matter what they think the solution is.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it is important that when we talk about what our options are, we include not just getting people off the street for the night,
mm-hmm.
but we talk about how is it that we are transforming people's lives.
Yeah.
And this is a place where I think across the political spectrum, right, conservatives want to talk about accountability and to say we don't want to just be putting someone up for the night forever.
Right.
I understand that, right? To say, okay, sure. Great. So how are we going to transform this person's life? Because kicking them out of the park to, like, sleep in someone's gutter
mm-hmm.
is not actually helping the situation. That's not changing anything. That's not transforming lives. And I think liberals want this sense of human dignity, that right, we got to treat each person with dignity. And I also agree with that. Mm-hmm. And to say, you know, as much as I am proud of our congregation for in years past hosting Safe Space and for the congregations that are doing it this year, I recognize that gives someone human dignity for a night
mm-hmm.
Or a few months, but that's not a transforming experience to give them dignity forever, because at the end of the day, sleeping in a crowded church hall with 30 other people who are snoring.
Yeah.
That's not the fullness of life that anyone's hoping for.
Yeah.
And to say, you gotta recognize where people are, and you gotta recognize that it takes steps for people to get to a healthier place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can build a coalition around that to say, how do we transform people's lives so that no one's living on the street?
Yeah. Yep. Ben, thank you so much. I often ask my guests to give a word of encouragement to our listeners, but that's all you've been today is encouraging, Ben, and I appreciate that so much.
And this is KZFR FM 90.1, Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this is Peace and Social Justice. I'm your third Friday host, Pastor Jesse Kearns. And this is another good day in the beautiful town of Chico. And we'd like to hear a little bit about how we can help our radio station.
You're welcome. I appreciate you, Jesse, and I appreciate that. You're trying to help people think through this issue, which is such an important one on both a practical civic level, but also on a deeply spiritual level.
Yep. Thank you for being a guest on the show, Ben. Hope to be seeing you soon.
Likewise.
Yay! Good All deal. Right.
KZFR is a non-commercial community radio station. That means advertising doesn't pay for the programs you're listening to now. We thrive thanks to donations from the public. We're truly listener-supported radio, and that's where you come in. We operate on a budget that's a fraction of other non-commercial stations in our area. 75% of our funding comes from listeners like you. That's 3 out of every 4 songs you hear on KZFR. 45 minutes out of every hour is paid for by donations from you. And that's okay, because we believe that the unique mix of music and news we provide is worth supporting, and you understand that. Our next pledge drive is March 5th through March 12th, and we're asking you to support this eclectic mix of programs. Shows just like The Real Issue, Ecotopia, Woody and Friends, Devastation Sounds, Two Penny Opera. You can't find them anywhere else on the radio. It's so important to make the call and stand up for something different. Stand up and support radio that's engaging, that takes chances, and that's there for you every time you tune in. And remember, your support for KZFR is what keeps this station on the air. Pledge online at kzfr.org today. Thank you.
And again, this is KZFR 90.1, people-powered community radio. Doing peace and justice all over this land. I finally figured out how we can play the interview that I had with Gail Hill and Deanna Schwab. So let us do that, shall we? And my first guests on Peace and Social Justice today are Deanna Schwab and Gail Hill, both of them who are with Safe Space Winter Shelter. And I've had a lot of listeners ask me, how are things going? How are things going with Safe Space? And I sort of know, but I really like to hear it from the people who are hands-on. And so it's always good to have Deanna and Gail on the show. Good morning. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you. So here's the big question. What is different about Safe Space Winter Shelter this year than has been in the past? First of all, give us a little brief history about Safe Space Winter Shelter, and then talk about how this year is different since this past year has been so different.
All right. I can answer that. So in the past, Safe Space has provided emergency temporary shelter during the coldest winter months here in Chico, primarily November through March. And we've done that through a rotating church model where a church will host a Safe Space and our 60-plus guests anywhere from 1 week to 2 weeks. We provide a safe place to sleep. We provide a warm meal and a safe sanctuary where people can respite from their travails out on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
This year, Safe Space looks quite a bit different than that for a couple of reasons. Number one, of course, being the COVID-19 pandemic. And number two, because we faced a lot of no's in our world in terms of what we could and could not do. For quite a while, we were stuck in the road because of the city's insistence that the churches that we participated in have sprinkler systems, which most of them do not.
I was going to say, which I might add, as being one of those host churches, has never been an issue in all the years.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of like one of those things we've operated under the radar in that regard, I guess, because we've never asked before, do churches need to have sprinklers? So we assumed that churches were exempt from that.
Right.
So, yeah, in all honesty, it was a bad on our part, but we simply were operating under the premise that churches were exempt from that requirement of having overhead sprinklers.
Right.
So that delayed us for about a good two months. Typically, we open in November, December. This year, we opened in February. February was our first week. So the reason it looks so different is because in the past, we've been a come-as-you-are shelter, and it was kind of a first-come, first-serve. This year, because of COVID-19, we have changed a lot of things. Number one, because of the social distancing, we are limited to 30 guests in the spaces where we used to have 60. We've also made a conscious decision to accept only those who are referred to us from either Enloe Hospital, Oroville Hospital, the Cancer Center, the Dialysis Center, the very, very highest medical needs in our unsheltered population.
Mm-hmm.
Because of COVID-19, our staff is an all-paid staff. They have been trained in COVID best practices and protocols. And we felt that we needed to provide a consistent, well-trained staff simply because of the COVID-19.
Right.
So it's, even though we have fewer guests, the shelter operations people have reported that these high needs people are require more attention and more care even than we imagined.
Mm, okay.
So we have been pretty quiet about our opening and quiet about where you can find us, right, simply because even with limited to 30 guests, we have more referrals than we have beds available. So we don't want people to have to come knock on our door and say, please, you know, I need a place, because we hate turning people away.
Right.
So it's very limited in scope and size, as I could say, the biggest thing that has changed about Safe Space.
Yeah.
One of the things that we saw that was a need that came to us is that when some of our unsheltered guests were treated at the hospital and then they were discharged, they're discharged back where? Out into the streets?
Yep.
I mean, if we had more hotel motel rooms and Project Room Key, that would be ideal, but we don't. And so there was a need that the churches saw that they could fill to say, we can take care of the medically vulnerable, even if it's just a few, as many as we can in our halls. And so that was another reason why we changed the name of Safe Space to Casey's Place. Mm-hmm. Casey Duran was a longtime and beloved volunteer with Safe Space, and she passed away this last December of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so in honor of her and her persistence, we said, let's call this Casey's Place a short-term emergency shelter for the medically vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And so yet another way in which Safe Space has sort of said, this is what we can do as part of helping within our community.
Yeah, that's great. I know that that was probably tough for an organization who welcomed everyone to put a limit. But I'm glad that it was for the most medically vulnerable, because they often get overlooked. And you're right. What do the hospitals do when they discharge them? They discharge them right out to the street, because what else can they do? Where else can they go, right? So you already said that there's, about 30 people per church that are being sheltered. Okay, you've got paid staff instead of volunteers. That's great. Is there still any – here's a question for you, because this is always something that we – kind of looked forward to that was fun was the meals, because that's we had a member of our church who that was her job. She was the water, giving out the water lady at our church, and it was never hard to get volunteers to come and be a part of the meal. How are meals being done in COVID world now?
Well, they are, you're right. You know, there's nothing that is more gratifying than bringing people together around a table of food. Yeah. There's just something magical that happens on both sides of that table. And unfortunately for COVID-19 this year, the people that are providing meals are bringing them to the parking lots of the churches that we are at. And then meals are being served by our staff.
Mm.
So it's less than ideal, but it is what it is, and we're doing the best we can. Anything you want to add, Gail?
I do, because even though there's, I guess, a little bit more hardships in the sense that all the meals are sort of prepackaged individually, mm-hmm. so that they can just be given to our guests. But what's really exciting is that when we opened up the opportunity for people to sign up for meals, we had a meal coordinator with a master schedule. Then within the first half of the first week, all of the slots were filled by not only individuals within the churches, and by the way, beyond the churches, we've had interfaith across the board that are helping with our meals, folks that couldn't provide space, that said, you know what, we can certainly take meals. But also, two other things emerged. One was folks that said, you know what, I want to help our small restaurants, local businesses here. So I'm going to buy 30 meals and give it to this restaurant so that they can deliver it to the people directly.
What a good
And idea. Still, there were other restaurants who said, you know what, we've had a hard year, but we still want to give. And so we have local restaurants that are donating meals as well to our guests. So it has been an incredible outpouring of light in a time that has been dark for so long.
Yeah, that's a good thing. That was another question that I was going to ask. But before I get into that, we do need to take a little break here to acknowledge our wonderful underwriters. And once we do that, we will be right back here on KZFR Peace and Social Justice.
And Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the local, seasonal, and organic offerings of Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farm Star Pizza at 2359 The Esplanade, at farmstarpizza.com, and on Facebook. The phone number to order is 343-2056. And by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. Now back to our interview on Peace and Social Justice.
If you're just tuning in, this is Peace and Social Justice here on KZFR, people-powered public radio. Excuse me, people-powered community radio. We are all about community here, and we are so thankful for our listeners and our underwriters and serving this wonderful community, this great community that not only encompasses Chico, but also a big swath of land between here and Red Bluff and down to the Sutter Buttes. We're thankful for all of your support. I'm your Third Friday host, Pastor Jesse Kearns, and I am here with Deanna Schwab and Gail Hill from Safe Space Winter Shelter, this year known as Casey's Place for the Medically Vulnerable, named after Casey Duran, a longtime volunteer. That must be tough Because I always looked forward to seeing a bright little yellow car out in front of the church, because I knew Casey was going to be there and that I'd get to visit with her. That must be tough, not seeing that little yellow car at the sites anymore. So let's talk about some, I call them God moments, God winks. Other people would just call them wonderful acts of kindness. And what have you seen this year in your dealings with Casey's Place? What are some of the things that are happening out there at the sites that are little God moments and acts of kindness?
Well, we've spoke earlier about just the outpouring of people that wanted to be in some way supportive of this community. Now, looking at the community themselves that have entered into our shelters, Deanna mentioned that because they are coming with some medically needs, so they are really just in need of quiet and care. Two men that came first or second night looked at each other and realized that they were friends. They'd known each other for 30 years, but hadn't seen each other in 4 years. And so they sat down to eat, and they were just chatting it up and just getting together. It was such a sweet reunion that we are told. Just a moment where God has brought two souls together, again, over a meal at a shelter in a place where their friendship has been rekindled.
Yeah, that's fun. So here's a question, and I've asked this many times, and I think we can't hear this enough. What is it that propels Safe Space? I know that we want to go beyond Safe Space as just a winter shelter. What propels your organization to care about the vulnerable and the unsheltered?
Well, I know what propels us, because you know, I've seen it in action over the last 8 years, and I am so pleased and proud to be a part of this organization who, from the top to the bottom, will absolutely not take no for an answer when it comes to serving our most vulnerable neighbors. Without a doubt, what propels us are our guests. Mm-hmm. What propels us is the passion that everyone deserves a place to put their head at night, to have clean water, to have adequate sanitation. I am so blessed to have known the guests and also the people that volunteer at Safe Space and our board of directors and our shelter operations. They come from the absolute widest variety of people you would ever imagine. These are people that I would have never crossed paths with. I still see people downtown who've been guests or previous guests, and they still know my name, and I still know theirs. It's just, it's such a blessing to watch people with just a little bit of care and tenderness and respect blossom. Mm-hmm. These folks don't have much, but the one currency that they have is respect. If you respect them peer to peer, rather than try to demand something from them or to treat them poorly or to treat them without genuineness, they can spot phony a mile away.
Right.
But if you are genuine, they respond so well. They're not that different than you and me. Yeah. They are not that different than you and me. And so I would say beyond a doubt that what propels us is sheltering the most vulnerable people in our city first.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I could add just a comment about that as well. I spend a lot of time in church as a pastor. <I hope so. laughs> And so we talk a lot about hope, right?
Yeah.
But I will tell you, and I mentioned this to the board last night, that the witness I have seen in this, the staff and the board on this idea of hope, is that in the uncertain days, there is this driving sort of understanding that we can actually make a difference and change the outcomes with people's lives. And it really is. That's why there is no no's, because the hope is always being able to see the potential results that our guests can have. And we have story upon story upon story about lives that have been changed and are doing incredible things. That is another part of what I think propels us, is that hope is real.
Yeah.
One starfish at a time.
Yeah. That was a Bill Such thing. Explain mm-hmm. that. Maybe not everybody knows what that means. Elaborate on that.
Well, that's the age-old story of the man who is on the seashore, and he would pick up a starfish and he'd throw it back in the ocean, and he was going along picking up starfish one at a time and throwing them in the ocean. And someone came along and they said, well, why are you doing that? You know, that's a waste of time. You can't save them all. And he said, well, I know I can't save them all, but I can save this one.
Yeah. Yep.
Something to that effect.
Yeah. Our Bill Such, former director of the Jesus Center, preached at our church, and he used that as an illustration. And a lot of our folks had never heard that illustration before, and I think it opens some people's minds and their understandings about what it means to help other people. And we find ourselves, we talk a lot about our housing crisis. This is another reason why you all exist, because clearly we have a housing crisis. We had a housing crisis before the campfire, and then we had a housing emergency throughout the campfire, and I don't think that has really diminished much at all. I think at very least we're still on very high crisis mode here as far as that goes. And so it doesn't, there are times when it is frustrating, because we are trying to appeal to people to open up their hearts and their minds and their wallets and whatever we can do to help other people. But whether it's due to compassion fatigue or just dealing with the grief and the trauma of what is happening in our community outside of this housing crisis, I feel that we need to step up and appeal to people to help. And so I'm reading a book right now, and I'll be talking about this with Ben Callahan later this morning. It's called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. And this is a book that was recommended to me just a week ago in a group that I was involved with. And he says that at a very deep, instinctive level, people want to do good works. They want to act morally and ethically. But yet I was at this meeting, a suggestion was laid out on the table that that's not the route that we should take to appeal for change here in Chico, that the only thing that people will listen to is how much money different programs can save the city and such. And what's terrible is, here I am, a proclaimer of hope and the good news, pausing and thinking, huh, maybe they're right. And that scared me, because my role is to proclaim good news, to appeal to people's morals, whatever that might be. How are you all making your moral appeal to people that support Safe Space? And I know that's a heck of a question.
It is, well, and I'll say that I do think that we're in a bit of a moral crisis. And I think that we have taken it to a level where we are trying to put it in an either-or category. You know, there is conservative, there's liberal, there's all kinds of divisions. And I worry about that, because I think that we need to let go of the word or and go back to the word and, because we all feel these things, we all see and are concerned about one another. I think that we need to step back. I think we need to listen to one another, even if we do not agree with the different solutions. We are so quick to defend on which side we are on. And I think we need to sort of be quiet and listen with as much compassion and understanding as we can afford to give one another. Right. And I think that would be a great start to working together.
Yeah. On both sides, we I think have lost the art of listening.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And listening with the intent to work together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to learn what the other person says, not listening and using that time to think of a rebuttal or a way to and unfortunately this has been happening for decades now, just this in the public square. We have forgotten how to listen to each other. We have forgotten to look at each other as human beings, fellow human beings, but rather we see each other for whatever political or sociological ideology we subscribe to. And I think this is a key for when we are dealing with our unsheltered. I try very hard to listen to people who are in that situation to help me understand where they're coming from and the hurt that they're experiencing. And, you know, even folks who are struggling with addiction and mental illness and things, you know, I don't think a lot of people understand. There's this idea that, oh, people want to be out on the streets. They choose to live this lifestyle. You know, I honestly don't think so, because I've honestly never spoken to a person who has communicated that. Mm-hmm. I've yet to find somebody who says, oh yeah, this is great. This is the life, man. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's, I think that's something that is key to our bringing people together to tackle the solution, is teaching each other to listen. That's just me. and I know it's you too. You all too. So here's the bonus question. If you were to project, look into your crystal ball, and look into the next 12 months, let's say that we achieve herd immunity by May or June and things get back to, quote, normal. I hope they don't go back to normal. I hope we aren't at all like we were before this happened. What is Safe Space going to look like in the following year or next season?
Well, it's in the 8 years that Safe Space has existed, we've always had a 7-year plan. I mean, every year we've planned to at some point in time be able to operate a year-round shelter.
Yes.
And that almost came true when Orange Street was available, but the not in my backyard voices kept that from happening.
Who we still need to listen to, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then we thought it was going to happen this summer on Carmichael, the former Department of Employment and Social Services out on Carmichael. And unfortunately, that was that building was sold to an out-of-state commercial cannabis company.
Wow.
So we've had some no's thrown our way, but it's still our goal to be able to serve people in that manner. What we're seeing is a little bit of a movement away from the congregate shelter. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because of obviously COVID.
Yeah.
But also because there has been so much success with Project Room Key, Project Room Key is not just a California phenomenon. It's throughout the entire country. Mm-hmm. Taking the most vulnerable people and putting them in hotel rooms to isolate them from the contagion of COVID-19. And what we've seen is absolutely astronomical, that if you give people a single room or, you know, single room occupancy and regular meals and regular case management, the results have absolutely been astounding. Astounding. I mean, even here in Butte County, and you know what a housing crisis there is in Butte County, that the county run Project Room Key has, I think they have serviced like 555 guests, and 28% of those they have converted into, they've exited them into permanent housing, permanent and transitional housing with case management. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a remarkable number considering the lack of housing we have here. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that every one of those people exited to their own home. It might mean that there are situations where there are roommates, housemates, you know, whatever. But we've seen the astounding results of a more, just a different type of housing. So they're looking a lot at transitioning hotels and motels, apartment buildings, dormitories, that sort of thing. So I'm hoping that we're still going to be able to look at a congregate setting, because that's kind of like elementary school. You know, you go to elementary school first before you go to junior high and before you go to college. Yeah. And the congregate shelter, the safe space model, has always been kind of the elementary school. This is where people start. Mm-hmm. We certainly don't want them to stay there. We want them to graduate to other things. Yeah. But I think it's an important part of the whole housing system.
Okay.
Did I go down a rabbit hole?
No, it's we're good. We're good right now. And I do want to express my appreciation for all the hard work that you have put into making this program happen this year. A lot of people wondered whether it was going to be able to happen. And we pulled together, and the community pulled together, and here we are. So thank you so much for all that work that you've done. And I hope to have you on the show sometime again.
And if you just tuned in, this is Peace and Social Justice here on KZFR 90.1, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento, the foothills, and beyond. We got a little off time, just a little bit. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show our love to our wonderful underwriters. Before the next segment, you're going to hear a little bit of pause in there saying that I'm going to give some love to our underwriters. But just ignore that, because this is a pre-recorded interview. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And by Wavian.com, supply heavy duty, NATO certified jerry cans for fuel and water. Wavian storage cans are the ultimate solution for safety, convenience, and style for disaster preparation, camping, or road trips. Visit Wavian.com for your safe water and fuel storage solutions. And I hope that you all will stay tuned after Peace and Justice for Playing Dead. As for now, I am going to go into the next interview, and I just wish you all the best. Go out there and do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly.
So my next guest is Mary Kearns. She's my go-to person when it comes to grief and trauma. Vocationally speaking, she is a hospice chaplain, but she also leads support groups for people who are dealing with grief. Welcome to the show.
Howdy, howdy.
Hey, I've been thinking a lot about this light at the end of the COVID tunnel that we've been in the last year, and we finally have a vaccine that seems to be working, and it looks like that maybe by the end of the year things should be back to normal, whatever that means. But I'm also thinking about people who've experienced great loss during the pandemic. I'm thinking about people who have lost jobs, business owners who've had to close their doors, and of course, most of all, people who have lost loved ones to the coronavirus. As a grief specialist, your specialty is dealing with loss and the grief that accompanies that loss. What are some things that we can expect to see as we're moving out of our current crisis situation and back into some semblance of normal?
Well, it seems to me that when you get out of crisis, when you're out of survival mode, then your brain and your body and your feelings can start emerging, and you may start experiencing what I call grief bursts, or just a resurgence of these losses. Now, I have said this before, and I'll say it again, Butte County is in loss overload.
Yeah.
You know, two major fires and then the pandemic. It's a double whammy, because if you've gone through those events, you're traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been a caretaker or a helper to people who have gone through those events, there's vicarious trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just compassion fatigue.
Right.
Because we've just been heavily smitten.
Yeah.
You know, that was a saying I heard back in the South when we lived there. Heavily smitten have we been. Heavily smitten. And that's just kind of where we're at. And so what is normal going to look like? In a regular bereavement group, we say, normal, it's not going back to what it once was. It's reinvesting in what the new normal is going to be.
Right.
And what that reinvestment is and what that looks like is going to be a case-by-case kind of situation.
Sure.
Whether it's people rebuilding homes in Butte County or moving away, or people who had one kind of job before the pandemic hit, and now they're looking for a different kind of job or doing something different. Reinvesting in that normal it's just going to be different. And so learning to just continue to be flexible and not have what I call a crazy goal list that would have been hard to do even in a normal world, but
yeah,
is now unimaginably impossible,
right,
after two major losses and a pandemic world.
See, when we talk about going back to normal, I'm kind of anxious about that, because I'm afraid that we are going to go back to the normal that was in place before COVID. And like you say, it was just the trauma that our community has experienced. We were in trauma to begin with. And so, you know, I'm certainly concerned about people going back to normal, the normal that we had beforehand. I know we've talked about how much trauma and grief our community has been through already after, you know, two devastating fire seasons and the housing emergency that followed those fires. How has the pandemic had an impact on this already existing trauma and grief in our communities?
Well, you know, as you stated earlier, in my day job, I work in hospice, and some of the things I'm running into, some of the stories I'm running into with families and patients is this repeated theme that this is not how it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this mourning of losing space that was important to them, a home, and then losing community, losing a job, and then coming, then having this devastating illness that's going to take their life as well. And learning how to come to terms. And honestly, not everyone comes to terms with that.
Right.
You know, some folks lament up to the day they die, mm-hmm. saying, this is not how it was supposed to be. This is not fair. And I hurt. And so holding space with that and comforting and just being that non-judgmental presence and supportive presence to them so that they can be heard 110%. So there's that aspect of it.
Let me back up again here and touch on something that has also been a concern of mine. You've got people who may have lost family members to COVID, and they're constantly being bombarded with people who don't believe that COVID is real or that it is as bad as people think. And what kind of an impact does that have on a person who has had loss, who has experienced firsthand the trauma of losing a loved one, and then they hear somebody diminishing it by saying that it's not even real?
Well, and that's so tricky because I'm trying to be gentle here. When anyone minimizes a loss you are going through, it's not going to produce any kind of resilience in the person who's being told to basically buck up and deal with it. If anything, it's going to anger that person. They're either going to isolate or they're going to start acting out,
mm-hmm.
you know, because grief will act out if it's not heard, if it's not actively mourned, and if it is not borne witness to. So the question is, how do we support people going through that or to reflect on how that's affecting people who don't feel heard?
Well, let's do that one first. Let's talk about the people who don't feel heard, because I remember having a similar discussion with you when we were talking about trauma after the fire, and people were, you know, saying out loud in restaurants, well, these people should just get over it. And, mm-hmm. you know, there were people there who had been through the fire who mm-hmm. were listening, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to bring that over into COVID world now and how we're mm-hmm. How we're coping and how people might respond to that or feel about that.
Well, I think bottom line, no matter what trauma you're going through, people need to be heard. People okay. need to feel seen and heard and validated that their suffering has happened, exists, and it's affecting them.
Mm-hmm.
My advice to people in the community is to continue to be decent, compassionate, listening human beings. I belong to a group where the moderator of the group is one of my former professors at Emanuel School of Religion, Dr. Jim Street, and it's Learning from Lament.
Mm.
And in this group, we talk about, you know, why people try to shut down someone who is actively grieving, actively mourning, actively saying, I hurt, why won't anyone listen?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about it, we've processed so many things, but bottom line, Dr. Street said, bottom line, someone who's trying to shut down another human being from their lament, from their hurt, is someone who truly has not known sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Truly. And if you haven't experienced it, then there's no empathy, there's no sympathy. And that is where you run into you know, folks who kind of have that callous thing. The other extreme of that is people perhaps who have experienced sorrow, but in their childhood or in their experience, they were shut down.
Mm.
So, you know, the thing I heard growing up was, don't you cry, because if you cry, I'll give you something to cry about, you yep, know, kind yep. of a thing.
Yeah.
And so the consequence is a bad pattern is being, you know, duplicated. It's like, well, I got through it without crying. Why can't you?
Right, right.
So again, you've almost got two people. And basically, no one likes to talk about suffering. People don't like to listen to suffering. The people who are listening, it reminds them, either I haven't gone through it and I don't know what to do, or I have been through it and no one listened to me. So if no one listened to me, then I'm not going to listen to you.
Right.
Just shut it down. That's not healthy.
Yeah.
That's not healthy. You know, there's a simple Swedish proverb out there that says a burden shared is half the burden.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of what I do in chaplaincy, I'm not a therapist. I don't write a care plan to fix someone's problems. I bear witness and I listen, and they find clarity and they find peace by unburdening their heart and their soul.
Right.
And then that's when the peace comes. Mm-hmm. That's just part of what I do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just going to keep telling Butte County, you know what? Dig deep and keep on being good, decent human beings. Mm-hmm. And if you think you're out of your compassion, dig deep and find more.
Yeah.
Because it's there. It's there.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a little break now to show thanksgiving for our wonderful underwriters. And then we'll be back for the rest of the interview. And if you've just tuned in, this is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR, and I am interviewing Mary Kearns, who is a grief specialist here in town, and we are talking about how trauma and grief factor into our current COVID situation and some of the things that we might be facing as we go back to whatever our normal is going to be. So this show is Peace and Justice, Peace and Social Justice. And I am an advocate, of course, for peace and social justice. And my hope, my desire is to educate and motivate people to make positive change. And it's kind of hard to do that when so many people are experiencing trauma and grief. What are some things that we can do to help and encourage one another so that we can work together to solve some of the complications that we're facing right now?
Well, I think folks who have experienced the trauma and grief, I would just encourage them to find some support, whether it's through Zoom meetings or some, you know, online therapy, anything where they can get an opportunity to talk about what's going on in their lives and how it's impacted them, because again, that sharing of the burden lessens the burden.
Right.
I do know that there's still some resources out there in regards to campfire support. I know up in Paradise, they still have a very active center up there. I guess, and I also know that folks, just be careful who you share to. Make sure it's someone who is a good listener. You know, try not to pull in the guy changing your tire into that kind of conversation. I know the clergy in this community have been operating and providing that kind of support as well. So just reach out. Don't be afraid. Try very, very hard to find ways to tell your story. If you can't find someone to listen to, write it down.
Mm-hmm.
Do some art. Take a walk. There are other ways to actively mourn those losses.
Yeah. So I want to get into something maybe that's I don't want to say personal, but it's kind of focusing in on families or individuals who have lost a member of their family. My concern is that they are going to develop calluses, emotional calluses, to the point where they've just given up hope altogether, that they have that they're going to sequester themselves from the social aspect of our society. What can we do? Well, first of all, how is that person's grief different than other people's grief, maybe? And what is it that we can do to support specifically those folks who are suffering a loss of a family member?
Well, there are many shades of grief, many aspects of it. And one part of grief is called disenfranchised grief, also known as hidden grief.
Okay.
And hidden grief can refer to anything that's unacknowledged or unvalidated by social norms. Mm. And this kind of grief is often minimized or not understood by others. And that it makes it particularly hard to process and work through. So
when you say minimized, what are you talking about?
Well, I remember a conversation I had with a friend when we mentioned a mutual acquaintance passed away from COVID, and my friend quickly interjected, "Oh no, he didn't die from COVID. He died from all the other things he was sick from.
All the comorbidities.
Yeah. He was sick from that. That's what got him. COVID didn't kill him." And you know, I had to really show some restraint and not kick him in the shins, or poke him in the nose, as a dear friend of mine likes to say. Yeah. Someone needs a good poke in the nose. And that's when, again, you're in a situation where someone minimizes it because they can't acknowledge that terrible thing has happened.
Right.
They can't acknowledge it. They don't want to. And so what that causes is a disenfranchised grief in people, and they feel like they can't share it. And so it goes deep. They don't acknowledge it. But grief is one of those things that I say in my support groups, your issues end up in your tissues. Mm. If you do not actively mourn a loss, and time does not heal wounds, only actively mourning losses heals the wound. Time does not do that.
That is interesting, because we say that little platitude to people so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had people, losses that happened in their childhood, come to me 30, 40 years later in my private practice and say, "Why am I depressed? Why can't I form meaningful relationships? Why do I have inability to trust?" You know, the list goes on and on. And then I'll do a grief timeline.